This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
I'm Beth Golay. Welcome to Marginalia. Idra Novi is a poet. She also translates works from Spanish and Portuguese, and now, with a new novel, she's writing fiction. Ways to Disappear is a novel about a celebrated Brazilian writer who climbs up an almond tree holding a suitcase and a cigar to escape a growing gambling debt. This climb occurs in the opening pages of the book, and what follows is the search for the author conducted by her translator and her grown children. I recently spoke with Novi about the book, her various genres, poetry, and climbing trees. Here's our conversation.
You have three books of poetry and have translated several notable books from Spanish and Portuguese. Ways to Disappear is your first novel, and to set it up, it's about a celebrated Brazilian novelist who has disappeared. Beatriz Yagoda, the novelist, has accrued a very large gambling debt, and she was last seen climbing a tree with a suitcase and a cigar in hand. And convinced that she knows Beatriz better than anyone, her Pittsburgh-based translator, Emma Newfield, flies to Brazil to help Raquel and Marcus, Beatriz's adult children, find their mother. How am I doing so far?
Sounds great.
Okay. And there are a few minor characters, the boyfriend and a publisher, but in this search, these three are thrown into a world of loan sharks, kidnappings, corruption, severed body parts. I've seen it described as a literary thriller, but this is the most elegant literary thriller I've ever read. In fact, one of the descriptions of Beatrice's work could very well describe Ways to Disappear, and I quote, "One of those stories so strange and spare that it felt like a whispered secret history of the world." You wrote that, or Emma wrote that, said that, thought that early in the book, and you are a poet, you're a translator, and now you're a novelist. Where would you shelve this book? I mean, how would you describe it?
What a great question. I think I, as a writer, am not easy to shelve, and I think I kept trying to live within these established genres, even though I myself was doing them all at once. And I think I reached a point in my 30s, and I decided that I wanted to do them all at once. And so I threw them all into one book. I threw in my ideas about translation. I threw in my the way I write a sentence as a poet, you know, with that kind of spareness. I threw in my interest as a fiction writer and my interest as a sister and a mother and a wife and a professor and a person in the world. And I just threw them all in one book. So I think I needed with this book to write a book that didn't behave. I needed to do something that didn't behave in terms of the categories. Does that make sense? I don't
Absolutely.
Know. I felt like I was trying to abide by these different, you know, these different train tracks. And then I decided to have them all on the same train. And maybe that's why, you know, they're describing it has been a little tricky because I wanted to transcend all of those sort of discrete categories.
I think you have. There are so many times that I was reading this book, and I'm not even going to bring them all up because my book is full of book darts where after I would read a sentence, I would just clutch my heart, if that's possible.
Aww,
I just would say,
you.
Oh, my word. So let's talk about Emma, the translator. You know, she felt like she knew Beatriz so well, and she often referred to Beatriz as her author. Yet wasn't she continually pondering what Beatriz was trying to say with her writing?
Yes, and I think that's one of the mysteries not only of translation, but of life in general, that the people that we think we know, we really only know a sliver of them. We know them in one role. We know them as a colleague. We know them as a neighbor. And you think that you know them, but you're really just defining them in one role. And other people probably define them in a completely different way. So in the book, I was really wanted to explore and play with the notion of definitions, how we define ourselves, how we define others, and the way we resist definition, because I think we all do.
Now, even though she had been translating Beatrice's work, Emma admits that until she met them, she hadn't considered the fact that Beatrice even had children. What was the disconnect between Beatrice and her kids? Why hadn't they read her work until after she disappeared? And was there a disconnect there, or was it just...
You know, I have found an interesting thing, both when I, as a translator and as a mother. It's the same thing about these narrow definitions that we have in each parts of our life. And I don't think you need to reconcile them. I don't think that your neighbor needs to know who you are at your job. And people at your job don't necessarily need to know who you are as a neighbor, right? Like, it's okay to have these different versions of yourself. I think it's almost necessary. It's part of just, you know, you can't reconcile all the different people that you are over the course of the day. And but what does that mean when in your absence? And I think I found in a lot of books that it's an often thing that we actually don't see a woman in particular in her totality until she's missing. And then you have to fill in her whole silhouette. And so I was just thinking about that, of how sometimes, you know, all the different things that we project onto a woman, how we want her to behave in this role and what we're expecting of her in that role. And what happens when she's gone? And then all of these ways that we've confined her into one identity, it's just this gaping silhouette, and you have to fill the whole thing in. So I think that was what I was interested in as a writer. You know, probably also I had some fantasies myself of disappearing into a tree.
Don't we all?
I had to be someplace one day. I had to be three places at the same time. And I was like sitting on my couch. I was exhausted. I've been up since 6 a.m. And I just thought, maybe I'll just climb into a tree and then I don't have to go to any of them. You know, it seems like a very attractive escape route to just climb into a tree with a book. And, you know.
Is that where the idea came from?
Yes.
Wow. And are you a climber of trees?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask you, are you actually a cigar smoker? No, I...
Are you a cigar smoker?
No, but I have an uncle who smokes cigars occasionally. But since I was small, he would always joke with me to, like, but I always felt there was something kind of transgressive and subversive about, like, taking this you know, the cigar, which we associate with men, and, like, being this kid who would, like, pretend to puff on it. So I was always very interested in, like, the symbolic sort of male symbol that the cigar is and appropriating it, you know, for women writers. Because I think even now in 2016, it's a very, we do a lot of casual gendering for women writers, of putting them in these terms, you know, of how we view them and who we compare them to, which is unfortunate, I think.
Well, and she was a surprising character. I mean, with the gambling, yes, but I still think of, you know, she found that coat and she kept it because of its pockets. And I mean, just things like that, that, you know, they surprised me, and I do enjoy being surprised when I read, so thank you.
Thank you. I enjoy being surprised when I write, so we're a good match.
Okay, there's a part in the book where Emma talks about desire, recalling a translation from one of Beatrice's books where desire is defined as what a man will deny himself until he won't. And when Emma translated it, she convinced Beatrice that won't should be can't. Desire is what a man will deny himself until he can't. And in the following chapter, her early publisher, Roberto, is recalling that same description of desire. We find out that she had originally written can't, and he convinced her to change the verb to won't. How do Emma and Roberto each relate to their specific word choices?
I think they refer to their specific word choices from their own cultural experience, as we all do. And I think the way we think about words and their meaning has to do with where we grow up and what we read and who our families are and how we talk to each other. And so I think for Roberto Rocha, as the first openly gay editor in Brazil, in a family, you know, that didn't support him, he brought that to the language that he used as an editor. And I think for Emma, as a woman growing up in the Midwest, she is thinking about how she's been confined and how her notions of desire and her expressions of desire have been confined by her culture.
Without giving too much away, one of the chapters features Emma facing a dilemma of symbolically betraying one man to protect another. You write, or perhaps Emma thinks, in translation, this kind of dilemma was known as domestication. A translator could justify moving around the objects in a sentence if it made it easier for her audience to grasp what was going on. She could even change an object into something more familiar to the reader to avoid baffling him with something he wouldn't understand. The problem with domesticating things this way, however, was the possible misplacement of truth. Talk about domestication a bit, not as a translator, maybe, but as it relates to human nature.
I think we all resist domestication, as pets do and animals do. And I just think that we all want a field to run in, you know. And I think that this book, in a way, was for me my act of resisting domestication. You know, I wrote it after having one kid and having another kid and a job and all these things going on in my life and a translation due. And I missed adventure. I wrote this book to have the adventure that I miss having. I felt overly domesticated, and this book for me was a way to resist that, and at least in my mind, to go on the kind of adventure I miss having.
The scene in the alley is one of the most action-filled scenes in the book, and it was written in a way that only a poet could have achieved. I don't know if it would be best to talk about it or to have you read it.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to read it.
Thank you.
So here they are in the alley, and a man has just emerged from a door with a gun. The sickening click of a trigger, the first blast in the bag still, Marcus slipping on the trash, the wrappers and roaches that burlap over his face, the nature of shadows being their lack of detail, the inability to know precisely how big and near, and Marcus calling Raquel, twisting in the man's hold, Emma at the wall considering whether to, if she moved, and if there's a gun on the table, it must go off, but if the gun is in a purse, if there are two guns, and the protagonist is holding neither of them, if the graffiti is red and large on the opposite wall, Louisa Flax that says, you were the one, the one, the one, or the wall displayed another name, or no name at all, just a web of lines that resembled letters, her mind filling the letters in as Raquel smelled the bacalao on his fingers, bit down into his thick palm, until her teeth broke the skin, until she tasted what lay beneath the skin, his blood beginning to, and he began to. She'd never been stunning, never publicly revered, but never weak, never hidden, never crazy, never gone. The man behind her yanked at her hair, jerked her head back. If there is a gun in a purse, its bullets traceable to no one, her finger bent, and the trigger went off. I've never read that out loud. That was so fun. I'm so glad you asked. You know, I wrote that section that way because my experience of violence in different parts of my life has generally been that it happens in fragments. And the way we remember traumatic experiences and violent experiences isn't as a coherent whole. I think that we experience violence in sort of flashes and sounds, and it's very sensory. You remember who pushed you. You remember what you fell against. You remember the sound. You remember something that squished under your foot. You remember it with your body. I think we recall violence, and we store violence in our bodies in the sensorial ways, what you smell, what you taste. I think that's at least been my experience of violence or being near to violence. So I wanted to write that way, the way that I feel that I, you know, have read or experienced violence.
Beatrice initially disappeared up a tree. Did other characters in the novel disappear in other ways?
I think everyone in the novel disappears at some point, as we all do. And I think the desire to disappear in some way is also human nature, because you're trying to disappear from certain definitions that no longer fit you. And I think, identity is fluid. And so the way we define ourselves and the way we define others also has to be fluid, but it's hard. I think we kind of stick each other in these fixed definitions, you know, of who you think your mother is, who you think your partner is, who you think your children are, who you think your translator is or your neighbor is. And then suddenly things in their life change. All of a sudden online, they've been clicking their way into some other identity you don't know about. You know, I mean, we all have these online lives that at some point I think can feel like you can get away with them and you can banish online now and you can recreate another person online quietly sitting right next to somebody who knows you really well and they can't see your screen. I mean, who knows what people are doing on their computers? That to me was like something I also really wanted to write about, you know, how online life has become a way to disappear from your own reality. You know, you can click to and become anyone you want. But I do think eventually it does catch up to you. And I think this book, in a way, is about how invented identities eventually catch up to who you are when you wake up in your own house.
I read an interview that you did in 2009 in the, I believe it was a blog called How a Poem Happens.
And you discussed your poem. You discussed your poem "Trans," and you said that you spent over 2 years on that poem. How long did you work on "Ways to Disappear"? Because this had poetry within prose within. I mean, this was more than just one poem, and I was just curious about how, you know, the process and how long it took.
It took me 5 years to finish this book, and I didn't tell anyone about it when I was working on it. My husband knew, and I had like one or two friends, but I really didn't tell anyone. And I think it just like Emma did. I mean, you know, she's not me, but there's definitely we have that common in that. I wanted the freedom of doing something where no one was expecting it. No one, you know, and I didn't have to explain it to anyone. I didn't want to have to define my book for anyone else. Because I also was resisting definitions, was feeling overly domesticated. So I wanted this one thing I was working on to have no definition except in the making of it, you know. And then within the book, I was playing with all these kinds of definitions. So it took me 5 years, and I did one draft, almost finished it before having my first son. And I related most to Raquel, to the writer's daughter, and I was writing it, and how she misunderstands her mother and how she felt as, you know, a professional woman in her 30s and negotiating her life in a city. And then after having my second child, I started to identify more with Beatrice as a writer, and my husband travels a lot to Chile. And so I'm often alone with two small children, like this week for 10 days at a time, I'm alone with two kids. And I was thinking about the difficulty of keeping your art alive as a writer when you're responsible for two small children, you know, and I started to identify with her struggle to do the kind of wild, undomesticated art that she felt this urgency to make, you know, and how you can disappear as a writer in your parenthood. You can disappear even from your own sense of yourself as a person apart from your responsibilities, you know, as a parent.
Since KMUW is an NPR member station, I think our listeners will appreciate this. In 2012, NPR's All Things Considered had a monthly series called News Poet, where they invited a poet into the newsroom to see how the news comes together and then write an original poem about the news. And you sat in and listened to editors and producers debate the day's news. You were influenced by an interview by Melissa Block with Daniel Day-Lewis, who talked about his role as the title character in the film Lincoln. In fact, you were inspired to use a line from the Gettysburg Address in your poem, which was ultimately about the then recent election, which you titled "A President Rehired." If you were to, do you remember?
I totally remember all that.
If you were to write a poem about the 2016 presidential election, what would it be titled?
Oh my goodness, that's a big question. What would I title about the 2016, you mean the election coming up?
Yeah.
Where has our country gone? I think I would call it something like that, or like, where, you know, in which direction are we going? Or let's get the country back on the road. We're in the field. We are in the field. We are off the road. Something like that, you know, in which my country, in which the election takes the direction of our country off the road.
You know, your entire interview with Robert Siegel was fantastic, but you said one thing that really sticks with me. After you had finished the poem, there was a shift in the news cycle when the CIA director David Petraeus announced his resignation. And this was news, but your poem was already complete. And you shared this observation of the differences between writing a poem and compiling the news. And I quote, "When you're writing a poem, all of a sudden something changes and it's between you and the poem and you throw it a line. But here, you throw out a story and put in another one. It sort of changes the way the whole country and all of the listeners see the day." And after that day, it seemed like you had gained a different appreciation for the news. Now that you are a poet, a translator, and a novelist, do you have a different appreciation for each?
I really do. And the conversation about fiction is much larger than the conversation about poetry and translation. And that's been really exciting, in part because it's given me the opportunity to talk about writers from other countries and talk about them with American listeners who might be interested even though they haven't heard about them. And so I take that role really seriously, and it gives me great joy to be able to do that.
That was Idra Novi speaking about her novel, Ways to Disappear, which was published by Little Brown & Company. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at kmuw.org or through iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens, our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.